The Church of God, the Eternal, presents Manifestations of Babylon Through the Ages, the fourth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Babylon, Past, Present, and Future, given for the third day of the Feast of Tabernacles, in Eugene, Oregon, October 2nd, 2023.
In the message yesterday, I finally gave you the answer in the back of the book concerning the origin of Babylon. After stringing you along for just a little bit, we went from Revelation back to Genesis. We made a stop in Isaiah and Daniel and a few other places to show you that truly this entity that God calls Babylon, Babylon the Great, that he defines as a whore, and something that embodies that which is despicable and that Jesus Christ is going to destroy. When you get down to the nuts and the bolts in it, what is it? It's an orientation of mind. Rebellion against God. God has his way. He has his plan. He has his purpose. He has instituted that upon this earth with the human family, and everything, anything that disagrees with that, contradicts that, seeks to undermine that or work against it, that's Babylon. So I've given you, I think, enough text to show you that it's not just about trying to identify in the last days a physical cabal of moneyed power brokers who are trying to do their nefarious work. And that's basically what the majority of other Church of God people, how they see it. So they think they're going to resist and stay out of Babylon by reading the news and keeping up with what's going on, you know, in the world scene, which is likewise a part of the deception of the enemy. Babylon has deceived the entire world and all its inhabitants, as we've read, and that includes a lot of Church of God people. Because that same spirit of deception has got them chasing the ball over here when what's really important is happening out of their sight or their vision. So if you see the truth, you're not being deceived and you recognize it for what it is. The prophecies in Revelation, Daniel, and others are not wowie-zowie stories to make us all titillated, you know, watching world events, sitting back eating popcorn to see how they unfold. Thankful that we're not a part of it. No, when you understand the truth of it, they are warnings by a loving God to his people who are at risk for our salvations right now. And he's saying, you must come out of this. Don't think you're out of it and just want to keep it at arm's length. No, he says, come out of her, my people. Implying, not implying, telling us very directly, we are in it. We have been in it. And if you and I want to be among those who are glorified in the day of the return of Jesus Christ, as we read opening night in Revelation 20, in that first fruits harvest, to be kings and priests and reign with Jesus Christ, then we've got a lot of personal work to do, every single one of us. So as I told you, the reality of this Babylon that God hates, it's between our ears. It's in the human mind. Started with Satan the devil, because he is the father of lies. And as Jesus Christ said from his own mouth, he was a murderer from the beginning. And yet God took that evil, rebellious nature, which Lucifer first manifested, and then he intentionally put that in us. So that now you and I are walking, talking rebels. We don't need Satan to make us rebels, we were already rebels. Which means if we're going to come out of Babylon, we've got to crucify the self. So I guess I could stop right there and say my sermons are over this feast. Because that's the most important point of the whole thing. But what we're going to do is continue on now with the remaining messages I have and try to amplify these principles and give you more that you can sink your teeth into spiritually, hopefully that will help you in your own personal walk. So we saw that it originated with Lucifer's rebellion. It manifested in the deception of Eve and Adam. And first persecuted, where was the first manifestation of the persecution of a human being? Was the murder of righteous Abel by his brother. So the spirit of murder preexisted it because it was in the mind and the heart of Satan. But it first manifested in an actual murder with the death of Abel. Then God later passed judgment upon that first Babylonian system in the days of Noah and destroyed it. So those aren't titled in the Bible with Babylon. But I think what I'm showing to you is that they are Babylonian. So it wasn't just Nimrod and that city-state called Babel. It's a philosophical orientation of mind that goes all the way back from the beginning. All right, so we went all the way back. We started at the end. We went all the way back. Now we're going to start marching forward again. We've already seen, what was the last, I think the last point I made to you is that Abraham was called out of Babylon. Some of you may not have been cognizant of that or thought of it in that way. He was basically a prince in Ur of the Chaldees, just another name for a region within Babylon. And so when God called Abram out and made him a wanderer for the rest of his life, he called Abraham out of Babylon. Now we're going to see that Egypt is just another variation in this analogy for Babylon. Symbolically, they are interchangeable. And I mentioned to you earlier that whether you say Egypt or Babylon, same thing. Let's notice a historical example. Now, historians argue over whether Egypt was the first culture, civic organization that originated, or whether it was Babylon. And you've got these different scholars who want to say, well, no, Egypt is older, or no, the Babylonians and, the Mesopotamia, they came first. So who came first and who absorbed the other's culture? So you don't, the scholars are not agreed on that at all. But as we've already seen, the Bible shows that Nimrod and Babel came first. Okay, so what we conclude, we would side with the scholars who provide evidence to say that Egypt then subsequently absorbed their concepts from Babylon. And then they just mimicked them. Now they all have their differences in culture and symbols and whatever else. But at the core, it's the same thing because it comes from the same source. So let's see an example of the manifestation of Babylonian philosophy in Egypt. So you're going to turn with me to Genesis 47, and we're going to read about some major events that took place at the hand of Joseph. Did you realize that Joseph was an instrument of Babylonian totalitarian government? That Joseph participated as a sponsor of the rise of a totalitarian oppressive regime. Well, you know he was number two under Pharaoh, right? God elevated him to that office. Do you think, therefore, that everything that Joseph did resulted in the kingdom of God on earth? It's not what happened. But there's an explanation for all of it. Genesis 47, beginning in verse 13. There was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And you remember this. God orchestrated this whole thing so that he used the jealousy of Joseph's brothers, who literally threw him in a pit and then sold him to the Egyptians to haul him off to captivity, and then God turned his servitude into raising him to the second position in the Egyptian government. Who could write a story like that? It's not fiction. It actually happened. So, and why? Well, God used Joseph's gift, inspiration to interpret the dream of Pharaoh, which was the catalyst for Pharaoh showing him that honor. And remember the dream? Pharaoh had this troubling dream about the skinny cows and the fat cows. And the explanation was that there was going to be 7 years of abundance from their crops and their agriculture, followed by 7 years of famine. And therefore, with that advanced knowledge about what was going to happen over a 14-year period, Pharaoh had the blessing from God through Joseph in order to prepare. And he put Joseph in charge of it. And basically what they did is they stockpiled all of the extra grain during the 7 first years and warehoused it so that they had food so that when the famine came, they could live. But what was the what was the result of that physically? And how did Pharaoh use it through Joseph as his instrument? Here we find out, verse 14, and Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn which they bought. Egypt under Joseph had a stockpile of food. And when all the people, both in the land of Egypt and in Canaan, which is where Jacob and his family had been, and remember in the famine, they had to move into the city, right? Just to eat. So now all the peoples, and basically what you have, up until this time, you have a decentralized type of government where people and families, by and large, had their own estates and grew their own food and had their own animals by which they could live and survive without the need of government. This famine changed everything. Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn which they bought. He was selling it. They weren't giving it away as charity. Wouldn't that have been nice? Here we've stockpiled all of this. Let's dole out some free food to help all these families in the region. Let's sell it and make a profit. And Joseph was the instrument of Pharaoh doing it. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. Pharaoh's getting rich off of this. And when money failed in the land of Egypt, meaning people ran out of money, they used what money they had, currency, to buy food until the money ran out. Now what are they going to do? When the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came unto Joseph and said, "Give us bread. Can we please have some charity now? Because we don't have any more money. For why should we die in thy presence?" In other words, are you going to let all of us starve to death? How about some mercy? For the money faileth. There's no more money. Verse 16, and Joseph said, oh, yes. And Pharaoh is so kind and benevolent here. Have some free food. No. Joseph said, give your cattle, your livestock, and I will give you for your cattle if money fails. If you don't have money, that's okay. You have some other resources that are likewise valuable to Pharaoh. You got livestock. You have cows, you have horses, you have donkeys, you have sheep. I will sell you more food and trade for your livestock. And they brought their cattle into Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses. Absolute economic transaction, no charity involved. For the flocks and for the cattle of thy herds and for the asses, and he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. Verse 18, when the year was ended, they came unto him in the second year and said unto him, we will not hide it from you. We're not going to try and shine you on. We're not going to tell you a sob story. But here's the fact. How that our money is spent, my Lord also hath our herds of cattle. You've got all our money, and now you have all the value of our livestock. There is not aught left in the sight of my Lord, but or except our bodies and our lands. Well, it was the only thing they had left of value. their persons, and their property, their land. So these people had land. From land comes wealth. You know what the number one physical counter to a totalitarian, communistic regime is? Independent wealth, especially by landowners. From land comes wealth, which is why in God's plan with ancient Israel, he gave every family land and created the law so that they would keep that land in perpetuity. It would never long-term be consolidated into the hands of just a few wealthy people who were smarter. The land always stayed eventually with the original descendants of the families because that's the source of freedom, physically. The ability to take care of yourself and your family without needing charity from a government or anybody else. So Joseph is participating on behalf of Pharaoh in robbing these people of their independence. Now, again, this was all God's will. I'm going to show you that, but hold your thought, because I don't want you to become bitter against Joseph. But understand, that's what was happening here. There is not aught left in the sight of my Lord, but our bodies and our lands. Verse 19, wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? You got to do something to help us, or the result is we're all going to die. And so they come up with a solution, because they already know what their dealings with Joseph have been. Buy us and our land for bread. Here's the deal. We will sell ourselves and our valuable property to Pharaoh if you will just not let us starve. And we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh. And give us seed, because we also need that. If we're going to plant, because we got to keep growing food, so we're going to sell ourselves as your slaves. Our property now becomes yours. And in return, we're going to need seed every year to plant the crops, that we may live and not die, and that the land be not desolate. Verse 20, and Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For the Egyptians sold every man his field because the famine prevailed over them, so that the land became Pharaoh's. What happened because of this famine? All the substance economically coalesced into the hands of one man at the head of one government. Verse 21, and as for the people, he removed them to cities. Oh, they couldn't all stay where they were because now it's not their property anymore. And you certainly need workers on the land, you know, to tend the crops. But the majority of them, he removed them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt, even to the other end thereof. Only the land of the priest bought he not. A special exemption for the pagan Egyptian priests. And isn't that very often the case where religionists, state-sponsored religionists, then have special privileges that the normal people don't? So they had their private lands that they didn't have to give up. The land of the priest bought he not, for the priest had a portion assigned them, Pharaoh. They had a special dispensation from the king to have their lands and the produce from that land. They stayed wealthy and did eat their portion, which Pharaoh gave them. Wherefore, they sold not their lands. Verse 23, then Joseph said unto the people, behold, I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. Let's just be clear about what this is. You are now the bondservant, the slave. You don't have the determination for yourself to do what you want and go where you will. You will do what we tell you to do, because you are our property. Lo, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the increase, when the crops come in on this land, that you shall give the fifth part unto Pharaoh, 20%. Oh, how benevolent. So they were going to do the work. In essence, for payment as like bond servants working the land to raise the crops, they were going to get to keep 80% of it. Woohoo! And they only had to pay a 20% tax of the produce to Pharaoh. Do you know what this is? This is feudalism. Popularized in the Middle Ages, in Europe, the British Isles, other places. It's called feudalism, where the people don't own the property, the king owns the property. And then the people are serfs who work the land and then pay a big portion to the king, and they get to keep enough in order to feed themselves and their families and to do it all over again the next year. Feudalism. And four parts shall be your own. For seed for the field, for your food. So he only spotted them seed for the first year. After that, now they have to, for the next year's seed to plant, they have to take it out of their 80% share. And for food for your little ones. Verse 25, and they said, thou hast saved our lives. Oh, they were so thankful. Because if you're given a choice between starvation for you and your family and not dying, you would be thankful to live, right? They said, thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day that Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land for the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's. There, my dear friends, is how you build a communistic, totalitarian regime. Babylonian to the core, in opposition to God's will for human families upon this earth. Anything that's in opposition to God's will, what do we call that? Babylon. This is Babylon. It's Egypt, but no, it's Babylon. Physically, that's what this was. Now, why did Joseph do this? He was fulfilling God's will. Remember what we saw a couple of days ago concerning King Nebuchadnezzar? Who gave Nebuchadnezzar that wealth and allowed him to ascend and create an empire out of Babylon that ruled the known world? God did. He gave him the circumstances, the opportunity, and the wherewithal to take hold and to rule. And as we read in Daniel, so that no one could resist his will. Who he would, he elevated, and who he didn't like, he put down. God did that. Well, God also did it with this Pharaoh of Egypt. He elevated and empowered the Pharaoh of Egypt through the hand of Joseph, because this was God's will. Joseph wasn't being evil or diabolical. He was doing exactly what God put him there to do. Why? Well, you can play it out, right? The end result was what? The long game. God plays the long game, not the short game. God was going to create a nation out of a little band of people called Israel. It started with one man and his 12 sons. And in the midst of Egypt, i.e. Babylon, they were going to grow into a significant family. And then God was going to bring them out. Oh, does that ring a bell? Abram came out of Babylon. Israel was going to come out of Egypt. Same thing. Israel was going to come out of Babylon, a totalitarian regime, sponsored with all the philosophy of those who hate God. And at the same time, he was going to make an example out of Pharaoh. He wanted the world to see what happens to a king, a pagan king, who operates outside of the restrictions and the guidance of God's law, and who is arrogant and would establish his own version of a kingdom on earth. And so God took it down, just like later, generations later, he would take down Babylon through the Persians. And then later he would take down the Persians with the Greeks. And then he would take down the Greeks with the Romans. God does it at his whim. He's the one who sets up and takes down, no matter what human beings think. So he elevated Pharaoh in Egypt so that they became the greatest society, economy, military power on the face of the earth in their day. In approximately the 200 years from this time of Joseph until the days of Moses. And in those 200 years, the Israelites had babies like rabbits. By God's design, they were fruitful. And they grew and they grew and they grew. And then what happened? A new Pharaoh comes along. He's not favorable to Joseph. By God's design, he raised up a man who put the new Pharaoh on the throne. God did. What kind of Pharaoh? A man who had certain characteristics. God didn't make him do anything. When it says God hardened his heart, God didn't force him against his will to think of a certain or to do a certain thing. He just put on the throne a man who had all of these arrogant, egotistical, greedy characteristics, and then prodded him with circumstances that he knew would react in a certain way to do exactly what he wanted. And that's what happened. So that God was absolutely justified then in making an example out of him and bringing him down. And that was the Pharaoh who died in the Red Sea. And I'm not turning to all the text. I'm just summarizing this story. You can read it in Exodus yourself. And what was the result of that? Pharaoh and his entire military was wiped out. The economy through the 10 plagues was absolutely obliterated. What God raised up under Joseph was absolutely obliterated under Moses. To show what? God's the one in charge of it all. And boy, did that send shockwaves through the rest of the known world when they knew what happened to the Egyptians, who they venerated as being the most powerful 800-pound gorilla that nobody could mess with. And then all of a sudden, they were destroyed. Especially the ones in the land of Canaan, the promised land, where the Israelites were marching. What theater? And God orchestrated it to affect the minds of human beings, to make a point. He's the one that rules in the kingdoms of men. So he uses totalitarian, oppressive, greedy regimes. And that's why he elevated the Egyptians and then turned around and neutralized them to make that point. It just took a few hundred years. And if you were someone who was there at the moment, you wouldn't see it, would you? You have to see the big picture of what God is doing over time in order to make all of that make sense. Well, it's right here in the Bible. You and I have the privilege and the honor to be able to do that with God's help. Okay, Exodus 1, verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph, didn't know Joseph, didn't care about Joseph, had his own agenda. And he said to the people, to his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. And population-wise, they outnumbered the natural-born Egyptians. And they were very adept. They were very skilled. They wielded a lot of power in their families. Come on, let us deal wisely with them. And who wouldn't? Lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. The enemy from within, he was deathly worried. They are not Egyptian. They're foreigners in our midst, even though they've been here for 200 years, or not 200, a lot of years, a few years. We need to get control of them before they get out of hand and destroy us. Therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. This is what Babylon does. Instead of taking care of the people, enriching the people, making it possible for the people to take care of themselves and to have wealth and positive lives, they oppress them with taxes and with burdens and obligations that make the weights of their lives more and more and more and more difficult. Does that ring a bell with any of you? And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramesses. Oh yeah, on the backs of the Israelite slaves, they build some incredible buildings. But the more they afflicted them, and they were trying to nullify them, reduce them, the more they multiplied and grew, because God was blessing them and their families. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel, and the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. The Egyptians were in Babylonian captivity, even though it had an Egyptian name. God then used Egypt to symbolize slavery to sin. So Babylon represents a system opposed to God, which enslaves humanity in plagues and curses, and Egypt is the same thing. They're one and the same symbol. Revelation 11, verse 7. Revelation 11, verse 7. When they shall have finished their testimony, this is speaking of the two witnesses now that one day are going to come on the scene somehow, someplace, some way, in order to fulfill the will of God, because he said it so here. Don't ask me who they are, and I ain't signing up for it, by the way. When they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascended out of the bottomless pit shall war against them, these servants of God, sent with the message of God. And the whole world hates the message, because when you tell the truth, everyone opposed to the truth will call you every name in the book. They will accuse you of hate speech. You're speaking hate. You make me feel uncomfortable. You need to be neutralized because you're bad for human society. We need government to control what is allowed to be said in public so that we can all be preserved against hateful, vile principles. What do you think they consider us? What do you think they're going to consider these two witnesses who are empowered for 3.5 years by God to tell the unvarnished truth and no one can stop them? What do you think that's going to be like? Just know what it is right now with these people trying to clamp down and restrict speech and where it's headed. It's getting worse every year. And the day that these two come on the scene and start preaching the truth, and I don't know what vehicle they're going to use to do it, that God's going to do it, but everybody around the world is going to get the message. They're not going to be able to throttle it by mainstream media or social media. Everyone's going to get the message and hear it, and nobody can shut them up. Imagine how frustrated the Babylonians are going to be. 3.5 years are going to be the most hated people. They're even going to be more hated than Donald Trump. For 3.5 years, they will speak with power and performing miracles, in essence, to back up what they're saying, and no one can stop them. Until God says, your ministry is complete. Thank you very much. When they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascended out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them. God's going to let them die as martyrs. And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city. What does God call the great city? It's Jerusalem. Make no mistake about it. But my point by giving you this passage, what does God call Jerusalem? Their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is Sodom and Egypt. See, God cares more about what's spiritual, not what's physical. What are these things physically happening? What do they imply or point to in reality? So it's Jerusalem. Well, Jerusalem is Jerusalem, and Egypt is Egypt, and Babylon is Babylon, not to God. If he will even take the physical city of Jerusalem in the Holy Land and call it Babylon, Egypt, Sodom, No. Sodom was over here, and there's still evidence of where that was. No. Jerusalem to God became Sodom and Egypt because of what they represent spiritually. And that's all that matters. That great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. In the book entitled The Two Babylons, page 13, Alexander Hislop, the author, states that the Phoenicians, who he says were the Canaanites of the day, the historians today, archaeologists will say they were the Phoenicians, that these people derived their religion from Babylon, as did Egypt and Greece. So among all of the, competing philosophies about who came first, Alexander Hislop is one who says Babylon came first, and then all of these other great nations and societies, including Egypt and Greece, absorbed, including the Phoenicians who were in the land of Canaan that the Israelites then supplanted. They all got their philosophies and orientation from the original Babylonians in the land of Sinar. Leviticus 18, verse 1. So God warned the Israelites. He brought them out with a high hand. He's going to take them to a promised land, previously inhabited for generations upon generations upon generations by these Canaanites, who were Babylonian in mental orientation, religiously, economically, everything else. And God warned them. Leviticus 18, verse 1, the Eternal spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and saying to them, I am the Eternal your God. Why does he have to keep reminding them? Because they keep forgetting, that's why. After the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein you dwelt, shall you not do. You were raised in a totalitarian, oppressive human regime that is opposed by God. And this is how you have been indoctrinated and what you're used to. You need to come out of that way of thinking, because I'm bringing you out now to be a free people with a whole different set of rules physically for society to make you and your families happy and blessed. But you got to give up your Babylonian ideology. You're steeped in it. After the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein you dwelt, shall you not do, and after the doings of the land of Canaan, these Phoenicians, whither I bring you, shall you not do, neither shall you walk in their ordinances. No feudal system, please. No communistic economic system where the king holds all of the property and the people are only slaves to work it for the king. You're not going to do that. You shall do my judgment, says God, and keep mine ordinances to walk therein. I am the Eternal your God. If they had done it, how blessed would they have been? But they never could do it for very long. And you know why? The enticement of the indigenous people. Ooh, the people who were there for thousands of years and were close to the land, they must have known something we don't. We should go and see how they used to serve their gods and dig up their little stone and wood and metal idols. There must be power in them. And by the way, look at the way they used to run their government. Doesn't it make sense that we should have social planners at the top who are smarter than the rest of us to help guide society from each according to his ability, to each according to his need? Doesn't that make perfect sense? And then we can all share equally without the haves and the have-nots. Why should just the smart people who are in the right place at the right time be able to assemble and have wealth, and the rest of us are poor paupers? We need to redistribute the wealth. Communism. And it sounds good, which is why so many young people easily grab onto it and get caught up in it. They think they're going to change the world. Oh, yes. Let's share everything. And what they don't understand is that human beings by nature are Babylonian, which means they're selfish and they're greedy and they're adulterous and they're covetous and they're idolatrous. And you cannot root that out of the human mind. So you're going to try and build a perfect society so that everybody is blessed and nobody is blessed. Because human beings can't do it without God. So that's what communism does. It entices the foolish. And then what do you end up with? Serfdom. And for all of the promises, you have a few wealthy at the top, and then the rest are all slaves of the state. And then you're encouraged to value the state and worship the state and serve the state with all of your being, even though they give you about that much in return. God's system says, no, wealth is in land. All of his children will have their own land. They will not be dependent upon the dole of the government. They will make their own food and raise their own animals. They will create their own wealth through their own hard work. And God only takes a small percentage as a tax. Which system would you rather have? It's Babylonian, my dear friends. And what you see in the world right now being expounded and celebrated and popularized and enacted more and more and more is modern Babylon. It's on the march. Oh, and by the way, it's not going to be stopped, so don't go out and join some political party thinking you can vote or have, you know, activities against it. Because what else is true? Our God is empowering it. Just like he empowered Pharaoh with Joseph, and just like he empowered Nebuchadnezzar, he's empowering Babylon today, which means you and I are not going to escape it. We're in it. What about the Israelites? Well, failure to obey God, he warned them, they wouldn't listen, and it resulted in their national captivity. That's always the end result. Their national captivity. He took them into captivity of the Assyrians and then the southern kingdom by the Babylonians. So the northern kingdom of Israel was taken by Assyria, which was originally, guess what, a colony of Babylon. Ironically, they were almost like sister states, if you will, back in the infancy of it. They grew into separate empires, the Assyrian Empire and Babylonian Empire, but they had the common roots. So the northern kingdom, because of their sins, God took into captivity of the Assyrians and they hauled them all off. And those were the northern tribes who disappeared from historical sight. Southern kingdom, southern kingdom about 120 years later, kingdom of Judah, also was removed by God into captivity by Babylon. You can verify that yourself, 2 Kings 24, 1 through 4. 24, 1 through 4, 10 through 16, and 1 Chronicles 9, 1. Won't take time to turn to it. Who did it? God did it. How did he do it? He used Babylon. So we're marching now forward in time. We've had Egypt. We've had Israel, very synoptically, being subdued and enslaved by Babylon, regardless of the name. Now we're going to move it to the New Testament. Who else was physically enslaved in Babylon? Notable character, I think you all know him. His name is Jesus Christ. Matthew 2, verse 1. Matthew 2, verse 1. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him. Verse 3, when Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Why? Because Herod was greedy, and would do anything personally to hold on to his power. And with a prophecy concerning a Messiah who was going to set Israel free from the Roman Empire and from him, by the way, and usher in a new enlightened period, that was a threat to Herod. He claimed to be a Jew and he was a Gentile. He was part Jew. But he was great and he was powerful, and he used his power selfishly, and he wanted to stomp out any vestige of this new quote-unquote Messiah because it threatened him personally. Drop down to verse 12. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, these wise men, then they departed into their own country another way. And when they were departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother and flee into Egypt. And be thou there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. The baby Jesus was in danger for his physical life because of this king. And the solution that God gave to his family, his stepfather and his mother, was to seek refuge, drumroll, in Egypt. Just like God provided a haven for Jacob and his family in light of a famine in Canaan that threatened to destroy them, and their haven was to seek salvation physically in Egypt where the food was. That's how they got there. So the same thing happened to Jesus. Verse 14, when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed into Egypt and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken, lest we think God kind of shoots from the hip and makes this up as he's going. He knew exactly what he's doing, and he knew exactly what every character was going to do by his own free will. He could just see the end of it before even they did it, including Herod. And he used it in his prophecies of old to accomplish his purpose in spite of the nefarious intentions of these rebels. And was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet. And this is the prophet Hosea, by the way, in Hosea 11, verse 1, saying, out of Egypt have I called my son. Isn't that interesting? A prophecy concerning Jesus Christ through Hosea. Out of Egypt have I called my son. You could interject instead of Egypt, Babylon. I've already showed you it's the same thing spiritually. Out of Babylon I've called my son. So Abram was called by God out of Babylon. Israel was called out of Egyptian Babylonianism. And then Jesus Christ was called out of Babylon. Do you see a pattern here? Do you think the Creator God of heaven and earth has an underlying theme that he's using in dealing with the human family through all of these ages? Seems pretty clear. And for you and me, it should help us to crystallize our conviction and our role in it and what he wants us to do. Yes, and then what happened? So now Jesus is in control of this. This is his family doing it, but God through the angel is telling them what to do. Jesus is fulfilling this symbolic trek out of Egypt as a child into the land of Galilee and Nazareth, where he was raised for the majority of his life before he began his adult ministry. And then when it was the right time, when he was age 30, what did he have to do? Jesus had to defeat Satan by resisting his temptation. We read part of that, Matthew 4, 1 through 11. I won't turn to it. My dear friends, this was the same kind of test that had been originally given to Eve and Adam. God made plain what was right versus what was wrong, and then he allowed a competitive philosophy to be introduced to them and made them choose. Jesus, as a baby, was raised to understand the law of God and the truth. He knew right from wrong. And then, in a weakened physical condition as an adult after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was subjected to the voice of a contrary spirit who was trying to give him an alternative to the truth of God. And he had to choose. Thank God he chose right. Because if he had not chosen right, then you and I wouldn't have any hope. But he did choose right. He showed the right way to do it compared to Adam and Eve and Cain and all the peoples in the day of Noah and ancient Israel and everyone else. He showed how to come out, not just physically come out of a region in the world called Egypt or Babylon, but in mind how to reject the philosophy of Babylon. By holding to the truth of God and resisting everything that opposes it, that's really when he proved he was not part of Babylon. The Roman Empire, in which the time period in which Jesus was born and raised and did his ministry, was dominated by the Roman Empire. And where did we talk about that before? Remember that prophecy in Daniel? Let's go back there again real quick. Daniel 2, verse 31 through 33. We read this before, but just to bring, because we're talking now about the days of Jesus Christ on the earth. And he was part of it. He was part of one of these Babylonian systems. Daniel 2, verse 31, "Thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold." That was Babylon proper. "His breast and his arms of silver." That was the Persian Empire that supplanted Babylon. "His belly and his thighs of brass." That was the Greek / Macedonian Empire under Alexander the Great. Verse 33, "His legs of iron." That's Rome. "His feet, part of iron and part of clay." That's the one that we're living in the last days. But Jesus Christ was raised in the manifestation of Babylon that was Roman. So again, I'm just saying this to prove to you that Rome is really Babylon, because it's a part of this image from head to foot. It's the same thing, regardless of what the name is of the time. Babylon, Persian, Greek, Roman, whatever. It's all the image. It's all the same image that Jesus Christ is going to destroy when he returns, by whatever name. So Jesus Christ was raised in Babylon. Even though he physically, with his family, came out of Egypt, he didn't come out of Babylon, because the Roman Empire dominated the known world, including Palestine, where he was raised. So he was still in Babylon, wasn't he? Of course he was. So the Jews, now here was the interesting thing about the Romans. One of the ways that they maintained their control, their empire domain for so long, they gave a certain amount of autonomy to their captured peoples. They would march their centurions in and take over, but they didn't want to put Romans in charge of everything. They would let the people rule themselves with their own form of government and culture and whatever else, as long as they didn't cause trouble and paid their taxes to Caesar. It's pretty clever. Pretty clever. And a dominated people who lost the war would say, "Well, that's better than being an outright slave. Okay." So a lot of their domains around the world, around the known world, did pretty good. And with the threat of the Romans who would march in there and take care of it, if there was a rebellion or an uprising, then okay, no, we'll behave ourselves and pay our taxes to Caesar and be thankful for what we have. The Jews, not so much. They just couldn't help themselves. Because after all, we're the people of God. We have a right to our independence. And Caesar is a usurper and he has no right to be here. So we're going to keep rebelling and rebelling and rebelling and rebelling. And the Jews made themselves such a thorn in the side of the Romans that Titus and his army eventually in 70 AD marched down there and just wiped out Jerusalem and the temple. they wouldn't submit. God told them to submit. They wouldn't submit. Babylon, in the manifestation of the Roman Empire, was God's will on the earth at the time. He empowered it, just like he did Nebuchadnezzar. So what did he want his people to do? Submit to the physical authority. Do not violate God's law, but do not resist and fight against this physical enterprise on the earth, because it is of God. For reason. Jews wouldn't learn the lesson. So that was the environment Jesus Christ was raised in. The Jews were always just waiting for their next act of insurrection. Which is why Pontius Pilate was there with a whole garrison of Romans to try to keep them in check. So that was the environment in which Jesus Christ was raised. It was Babylonian, even though it was Roman. So what's my point? So the Jews, the Sanhedrin, all right, who are in charge religiously of the people, and also then they could enforce laws over the Jewish people except for the death penalty, right? So the Romans let them handle a lot of the civic justice system except for capital punishment. But it was still under the dominance, the allowance of the Romans. What does that have to do with anything? Well, the murder of Jesus Christ was one of those murders that God attributed to Babylon and Satan. What? Yeah. It was done at the hands of the Jews. The Jews were the ones who literally set up Jesus and had him killed, right? Even though they had to get Roman authority to do it. Who sponsored the murder? The Jews. And isn't it ironic? The Jews hated the Romans. Check this out. The Jews, the Sanhedrin, they hated the Romans, and they wanted so much to be free from Rome. So let me rephrase. The Jews wanted so much to be free from Babylonianism. Because after all, they were the people of God, and they had the right to the worship at the temple, according to the promises of God to the nation in the Bible. They hated the Romans. They hated Babylonianism. They wanted nothing to do with it. They didn't want to use their money, but they had to. But they wanted to be separate. But were they? Not at all. And in fact, the Jews, while claiming to hate the Romans, were the ones who perpetrated Babylonianism in the killing of the Messiah. Revelation 18 again. Keep going back there, because all roads lead to, Rome. No, all roads lead to Babylon. The second part of verse 23, Revelation 18, for thy merchants, and there's always money, commerce involved. Thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. And in her, this Babylonian system, was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and of all that were slain upon the earth. Every single human being ever slain by murder. God said through John, Babylon did it. That must include Jesus Christ. Can you exclude him? Of course not. All that were slain, including the Messiah. Yes, the Romans did it. Pilate had to give the order. But who was behind it? Who agitated for it? Who pushed it? Who played the political games to make Pilate fearful of not giving the Jews what they wanted for fear that word would get back to Caesar and then Caesar would remove Pontius Pilate and put somebody else in his place? See, he was playing defense too. Who was behind it? The Jews. Who hated the Romans, but did they really? No, they were Babylonian to the core. They were no different because they were operating according to the spirit of rebellion against the will of God. So you tell me who was better or who was worse. They were all the same. So what's the point? Being religious will not save you. Even as it didn't save the Jews from their guilt Oh, they were pious. Oh, they loved the Ten Commandments. They were champions for the law of God. And they did the will of Babylon. So why were they better off? They weren't. Did they see it? No, they had no clue. They had no clue. Are we any smarter? Do you think we can see things better than they did? That we're better at moving, you know, jiving and avoiding being a part of the, you know, the bad people? Oh, so I've got the Bible prophecies. I know they're going to do this. Those bad people are going to do these bad things. I'm not part of that. I'm over here. Just like the Jews said, we hate the Romans. We hate Babylon. We're not part of it. We're on God's side. But they weren't. Because again, Babylon was between their ears. Babylon was the way they think by nature. Their default position is rebellion against God. So that everything that they did absolutely fulfilled God's prophecies concerning the death of the Messiah, the Son of God. And they did it, and they were guilty. And God says Babylon killed Christ, because he's included here in verse 24. Babylon killed Jesus Christ. The Jews in the first century killed Jesus Christ. Therefore, the Jews were Babylonian. Regardless of what they call themselves, God looks on the heart. He looks on their actions and their philosophies. And that's what matters. Next time, now we're going to take the next step, and we're going to see what all of this history has in common under an umbrella as we march our way toward the end of this feast.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented Manifestations of Babylon Through the Ages, the fourth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Babylon, Past, Present, and Future, given for the third day of the Feast of Tabernacles, in Eugene, Oregon, October 2nd, 2023. Thank you.